home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening. It is Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Garrett Miller is off on assignment, and it's me. Tonight, we're going to dig into a couple of things. One is the current political happenings with scandal and intrigue and incompetence and Donald Trump and, where do we go from here as a country? And, you know, it's all falling apart all around us. And what are we going to do? So we can't avoid talking about that. So that will definitely be on the plate. But also, my source tonight is, who I will be bringing on in just a minute, is my very good friend and one of the top journalists in the country, Brody Levesque, who is a top journalist in all measures, political and current affairs, but specifically focuses in on the LGBT community and knows probably more about everything that's been happening for us than virtually anybody else in the field. So we're going to tap his brain on, you know, how these scandals impact the LGBT community, if at all. We're also going to talk about things that are going on that may not be as well known that are current or future threats to us. But the other thing, and one of the main topics I wanted to talk about tonight, is a new campaign that is being done by the HRC that they announced recently, called HRC Rising. And it is meant to be a resist movement against Trump Pence. And they are pouring millions of dollars into this and a big, big press to do about it. And I have to be blunt. I don't quite get it. I don't quite get exactly what they're going to do. And I have the specifics here, which I will share with you and Brody when I bring him on. But I figure that if there's anybody out there who's going to be able to explain this to me and to us so that we can get it from an unbiased source, it would be Mr. Levesque. So that will be kind of the main topic of the evening when we get to it. So without further ado, I want to welcome Brody to the show. Welcome. Good evening, Brody.
Hey, good evening, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. You're doing even better. I saw what you ate tonight on Facebook. It was looked pretty extraordinary. So, and I know you're sipping tea and, past dinner time. So life should be good.
Life is okay. It's been a long week. And I have to give a shout out and credit to the other journalists who work just as hard as I do. I don't necessarily consider myself one of the premier journalists. I'm in the trenches along with the rest of them. And the work that we do these days, particularly in the LGBTQI community, it's very difficult. It's very hard. I'd really like to acknowledge Mike Wavers and Chris Johnson at the Washington Blade, because they do yeoman work for the Blade. Phil's uncle in Los Angeles, Morgan Hurley in San Diego, Colin Murphy at Boom Magazine in St. Louis, and the crew up at the Bay Area Reporter. These are all really Mark Siegel and his folks, John Wright, just all of these people are just so critically important to our profession, and particularly these days for the community, because more than ever before, the community is under siege, and it's really important that we resist and fight back and make sure that we don't get run over by the times and by the people that, quite frankly, would see harm done to us. And on that happy note,
you broke up there.
I'll let you play host.
Well, and just to let you know, I consider in the trenches the only place you would find a premier journalist. So, that's that. So let's go into what has been happening behind the scenes. I think there are some things that may not be widely known that happened this week regarding the LGBT community specifically. What is happening on that beat?
The largest fight this week was for the trans community. We had a situation where Representative Vicky Hartzler of Missouri, who is virulently anti-gay, anti-trans, she's just, quite frankly, completely biased and prejudiced, particularly towards the trans community, had attached an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act. Now, this is a yearly piece of legislation that essentially funds the Defense Department for the next fiscal year. And everyone in Congress has a chance to attach amendments. Normally, that's done through the House Armed Services Committee, which Hartzler is a member of. But anyone, theoretically, that you know, in that body, all 435 of them, you know, could attach something. Unfortunately, the amendment that she put on there would have literally taken away the ability for most people that were trans to be able to serve in the military in terms of their health care, transitioning costs, pharmaceuticals, necessary care. In a floor speech today before the vote, Representative Duncan Hunter of Southern California, who is also no fan of the LGBTQI community, essentially stated that that's fine if you want to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces, be it as a man, be it as a woman, just transition before you come in the military. And it unfortunately also leaves out people in the U.S. Armed Forces who are currently transitioning or have transitioned. And this was a very onerous amendment. Had it gone through and had it gone to the Senate and had it gone through the Senate to the president's desk, it essentially would have meant that it would have taken away needed funding for anyone who was transgendered wearing a uniform. Now, in addition to Representative Hartzler and Representative Duncan, Representative King of Iowa, who's also a known anti-gay person, had put an amendment forth. The language was similar to hers. He withdrew his. We came to find out that the major pushing for this piece of legislation through her, this amendment, was coming from the Heritage Foundation, the Family Research Council, and the Vice President of the United States through the Speaker of the House of Representatives. In the vote this afternoon, however, it was a close vote. The tide was turned with a lot of work, and I have to give a shout out to OutServe and Matt Thorne and his group, the Human Rights Campaign, and I have to give a shout out to the Palm Center, particularly Mariah, their Hill rep. I have to give a shout out to the Freedom Initiative and a lot of the other people in the LGBTQI community that for the last almost 48 hours worked very hard. The vote came out 214 to 209. It was a squeaker. Now, we're not completely out of the woods yet with the legislation. There's still an opportunity for it to be attached by the Senate. However, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee is John McCain. It's not very likely that Senator McCain is going to even allow that. McCain wants a clean NDAA. The other part of it was that the Defense Department doesn't want this. The Secretary doesn't want this. Secretary Mattis had even called at one point one of the representatives to lobby against it. The Defense Department is, and the Secretary is in a position where they don't want to sit there and play with these social issues. They want to be able to do their jobs. And it's very difficult to do that when you have distractions like this going on. This is a fight they don't want to fight. The Secretary has already delayed what we call an accessions policy for the trans community until December. But this piece of legislation was just, it was above and beyond. It was a seriously discriminatory amendment. It was hateful. There's no other way of, you know, classifying this other than to say it was hateful. So at this point, it's a victory that's done. Now, again, we're not completely out of the woods. But I really don't think, based on, you know, the sources I've got on Capitol Hill and conversations I've had, that we're going to have a problem, because Senator McCain doesn't want this kind of nonsense either. So the bill will go to conference. There's a Senate bill. There's the House bill. There's what they call a reconciliation process.
right.
conference. The conferees get together. They decide what they're going to want. That gets done. It's voted on. Then it goes to the president for signature. The community has to be very, very aware of the fact that there is serious opposition in the way of these so-called family, you know, values groups and Christian groups, and the Vice President of the United States. The Vice President was a major consideration in this, and this is something that, you know, people need to be very, very aware of. So that was this week, and again, the vote happened at about roughly 5 to 5:30 this afternoon. I don't remember exactly when. It's 10:15 here now, so it was about 5 hours ago. But it was significant. The other thing that was significant about it was the amount of vitriol. Yeah, go ahead.
You pointed out kind of the key player here that I think would be a surprise, probably not a big surprise, but just a surprise on why he would put this kind of energy into this specific thing is the vice president. I mean, the rest of the cast of characters are the complete goons. I mean, they're the people that were behind Kim Davis. They're the people that were, you know, just really constantly looking to create hate and trouble elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the real center stage of this, which is who are the Republicans? And obviously there had to be some who voted against this and did not allow the House bill to go through that way.
They were moderates. And several of them, without going into specifics, were sitting on the fence. And again, the work that was done by the advocacy groups, and we're talking in the 11th hour, okay, in the 11th
right.
hour, literally, okay, you know, made a significant difference. Matt Thorne, who's the executive director of OutServe and Servicemen's Legal Defense, and he's a board member of the Victory Fund, and Jennifer Pike Bailey, who is the senior public policy advocate for the Human Rights Campaign, along with Mariah Sixkiller from Sixkiller Consulting. She's actually, her client was the Palm Center. These are the critical players in lobbying and talking to people and trying to get the, you know, the crew on the Hill to be able to understand this. And again, there was a list of well over a dozen moderate Republicans who, quite frankly, were not in favor of this. Again, Hartzler is an extremist. There's no other way of categorizing the representative. And sometimes the over the top, if you will, from these extreme social conservatives like Hartzler just does not fit well. The other thing is that she has made some egregious statements about the transgender community in the past few weeks, and that wasn't sitting well with these people. So overall, I think that, you know, it needs to be noted, okay, that, you know, there was so much work, okay, that was put into this. And there's a lot of credit. You know, the Transgender Law Center, Mara Kissling, who's head of Trans Equality. Mara, I know personally. She's great. The Military Partners folks, Stephen, Evan Young at the Trans Veterans Org, Ashley at Military Partners. You know, these are the people, and, of course, the Ian and the crew at the American Civil Liberties Union. These people did an amazing, amazing job of you know, putting together, if you will, a whip count. And making, you know, effective points so that the moderate Republicans sitting in Congress could get a crystal clear understanding of the type of damage that this would do. And at the end of the day, the fact was that the Defense Department didn't want this amendment. There was a bunch of other amendments
right.
on the
NDA.
But this one in particular,
That's the thing about this whole process and everything else. It solves nothing and creates actual real problems because, you know, regardless
yes.
of the transphobia behind it, you know, you have people mm-hmm. who are dealing with their lives, their health, their, you know, things that are going on with them. And when they can't solve them in their lives and they're in uniform, that is going to have an effect on morale, their unit, their superiors who are trying to do something for them. That, you know, it's like they raise it up. You know, it creates this chaos and the imbalance because it's not fair, because other service members who have their own health issues are getting those taken care of. So it throws off equanimity across the board in just process and practical things. So the people behind the infrastructure and behind everything, you know, it serves no positive purpose. And I can't see in the biggest scope of things that it saves, you know, any kind of significant money whatsoever. In fact, the chaos it probably would create would probably cost more than just providing the services directly and, you know, making everything run smoothly. So I can't see anybody who has any practicality about it. And my one observation, though, Brody, of what you just shared, it harkens me back to a point in California politics many years ago when California wasn't a progressive state. You know, it was like we had plenty of anti-gay stuff going on. And in fact, Ed Davis, who had been police chief in Los Angeles, was now up in the Senate. And I don't remember exactly the bill that was happening at the time, but it was something very, you know, impactful for the gay community. And he ended up coming out pro-gay on the pro-gay side and being part of the swing that shifted LGBT politics in California. And the reason he did was because of the lobbying by the anti-side and how adamantly horrible and awful they were. They were actually the factor that convinced him otherwise. They were not their own friends, in other words. And I hear that.
Well, there's when people like Hartzler, okay, refer to the transgender service members, and this includes the ones that are serving now, and she did. She compared them to ISIS and North Korea, even the Russian Federation's president. You know, she labeled them, you know, a domestic threat. And then, of course, Tony Perkins, you know, it's, you know, she was on his show, and she's sitting there saying, you know, and I'll quote, this is actually something that Representative Hartzler said, and I quote, "We're having to deal with a threat here at home, a domestic threat of allowing transgenders," spelling incorrect, "in our service, which is a real problem because it impacts their readiness, and it's a huge cost for our military." Now, that's a false claim, okay?
Right.
It's the, you know, the folks at, you know, Think Progress were able to point out just how wrong she was on that. Okay. And the thing is that, you know, we can't keep going down this road with these family groups because it's, they keep, you know, banging away. The thing about this battle that made it different from the Don't Ask, Don't Tell battle, this was not the same thing. This is completely different. There was a mischaracterization by one of the gay groups, and I'm not going to point the finger, but one of the gay groups miscategorized this and kept banging away and saying that it was another repeat of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's not true. This is apples and oranges. The problem with this,
right?
Okay, and let me outline what, you know, my colleague Chris Johnson, who's the Washington Blade's White House reporter, said. Okay, I'm quoting Chris. "Not only would transition-related care like hormone therapy and gender reassignment surgery be off-limits to transgender troops, but the amendment would also bar the military from paying for transition-related care for the dependent of a service member, such as a spouse or a child, who's transgender. Transition-related or gender-affirming health care has, in fact, been deemed medically necessary." Okay. The other thing that Chris pointed out, and I agreed with, and I think that everybody was talking about, you know, and I'll quote Chris again, "It would be the first time in history that the United States has considered a measure specifically aimed at rolling back rights in this case, for trans people. And that's exactly what it would have been. So this was not don't ask, don't tell. This was actually, believe it or not, worse. Because I have many, many, many friends in the trans community. As you know, I'm an ally and an advocate for the community. Every single person that I reached out and spoke to over the last two or three days has told me the same thing, that had this amendment gone through, had it gone through conference, had it gone through the Senate, had Trump signed it, it would have literally been a health threat to transgender service people. Okay.
Oh yeah, so of course. Yeah, absolutely.
This was different. You know, Rob, the animus that's displayed, I have a simple term for it. Okay. And this is the term, and I'm sure that, you know, if Mara and some of my trans friends are listening, they're not going to like this, but it's true. The problem here is that we're talking about the ick factor. And that is something that is in a class of discriminatory practices all on its own. You know, you and I have had conversations in private, and we've had conversations before on this show and on your Out in Santa Cruz program, where we've talked about the ick factor, but we haven't really specifically said, okay, well, this is what it truly is. This is what it truly is. And we need to be in a place now where we get over that, okay? I spoke with Julia Scotti this afternoon before the vote. Julia, as you know, is a comedian, and she is trans herself. And she said to me, she said, Brody, what's wrong with these people? Why can't they just not leave us alone? I don't have an answer for that. The only thing that I keep coming back to is
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I'm not, I mean, the ick factor is certainly there, and it isn't just the transgender community. I mean, the ick factor has certainly given gag reflexes over the LGBT community as well, and, you know, and a lot of parts throughout history. I see an even greater parallel between this and the rhetoric I've heard over the years around AIDS funding and HIV funding. It's that it's kind of a rich person privilege hoarding kind of position of, you have a problem or you have a challenge that I don't have, therefore, I'm the baseline. You go away. It's your problem. You created it. Deal with it yourself. You know, it's that cold Ebenezer Scrooge-ish kind of attitude that I hear from it. So, you know, but whatever. It's, you know, it's we're now trying to analyze hatred, and that has a whole other darkness to itself. That you know. We're looking for logic where logic may not exist. I do want to switch here, though, to a little bit towards the main topic that we've got the show titled on tonight to ask you about, but it's related because it has to do with the positive side or the positive aspect of this, and that's the grassroots movement. HRC announced, I think it was this week, HRC Rising, a campaign to accelerate progress in states from coast to coast, resist the politics of hate, fight anti-LGBTQ legislation, and fuel pro-equality candidates and initiatives. And they go on, you know, at length on the HRC site talking about what this is, and this is the largest grassroots expansion in their 37-year history. They talk about an army of over 3 million, and then they give a figure that all LGBT voters combined in the last election were 10 million. So this theoretical army of 3 million sounds like it's one in every three LGBTQ voter from the last election is in this quote-unquote army. And then it talks about the money and how it's going out. And it talks about how it's going through about 32 existing volunteer-led local steering committees to expand local partnerships, recruit additional volunteers, mobilize constituents, register voters, and grow the organization's grassroots army to flex political muscle in legislature and at the ballot box. So here's my question. I don't hear strategy in that. And I don't hear going after big issues that are coming up. Like you and I've talked about the, you know, severe health crisis that is happening, going to happen even more in the South with people of color and HIV. This doesn't say anything about, you know, the homeless population that is so heavily LGBTQ youth. It doesn't talk about the trans issues of healthcare, even without what just happened in Congress, which in theory, to your point, HRC was part of this, so that could be part of this movement. But it sounds like a lot of infrastructure building of organizations and committees and not necessarily the stuff that is necessarily going to be that effective. And so that's my question to you. Is this a real thing that is going to be a movement for us that will protect us on the issues that are coming up?
I'm going to be completely transparent. I have reservations. And the reason I have reservations is because the Human Rights Campaign history until most recently, in terms of playing nice in the sandbox with other LGBTQI groups, advocacy, grassroots, equality groups, was not good. Particularly when Joel Solomonese headed the organization. Now, the current head, Chad Griffin, has made, I think, significant inroads in terms of trying to alter HRC's course. But my questioning of this particular initiative is, are we raising a bunch of money and we're hiring a bunch of staff when, quite frankly, we've got equality groups on the ground already? Why are we not spending money and effort to successfully shore up those organizations? HRC and Equality North Carolina proved that an equality group and the Human Rights Campaign can work together and make a significant difference. So my question to the folks at HRC headquarters over there on Rhode Island Avenue in D.C. would be, okay, you can do that with Equality North Carolina. Can you partner with Equality Texas? Can you partner with the LGBTI centers that need your help? And these are the people that are community leaders on the ground. Will Bass and the crew in Memphis.
You're raising a good point. Because
Will Bass.
Wait. I have a point before you finish. I have a point in conjunction before you move on to another part of your point. Is the indivisibility movement throughout the country is setting out to do, from a real grassroots perspective, the same thing. So that feeds into your point.
Well, the grassroots, like I started to say, you know, Will Batts and the crew in Memphis at the LGBTI Center, Will and I are old friends. We've had numerous conversations. Will has a high percentage of LGBTQI folks of color that he helps, okay? Toby Jenkins, who's another friend who runs the Donald McKeel LGBTQI Center in Tulsa, has a huge population of the trans community that he helps. Carl Siciliano and the crew at the LA Forney Center in New York, of course, work to help, you know, the youth that are homeless and disenfranchised in the city of New York. These would be, to me, a logical starting point for the Human Rights Campaign to invest not only funds in, but also invest resources in, because now you've got a place to take off from and work out of with people that are already in the community, that know these communities, have already got a proven track record of initiatives on their own for what they're doing. You know, John Cole and the crew at Equality Tennessee, for example, who's friends with Will, and I know John as well. You know, they've been fighting all sorts of horrible things coming out of Knoxville, everything from don't say gay to you name it. And they have got a proven track record. So while I applaud what the Human Rights Campaign is doing, I'm still questioning whether or not, you know, if they're going to go into places that don't have infrastructure, like let's say Nebraska, for a good example, where there's nothing there, okay, then yeah, I would say there's a perfect opportunity. The two largest cities are Lincoln, the capital, Omaha, okay, to the south, and most of the LGBTQI community is of Nebraska split really between those two cities. So there's a starting point. So there I could see a standalone human rights campaign effort. But if you've got infrastructure and people already in place, why are we not doing anything to embolden, and why are we not doing anything to be proactive about expanding those efforts in those places where it already exists? Equality, Texas,
well,
for example, has been carrying the water. Why are we not dumping money into them and the efforts that they're putting up, because they're standing there fighting some pretty onerous anti-LGBTI legislation and an extremely hostile legislature, attorney general, lieutenant governor, and governor? That's my question.
Well, and that's kind of the point, though, too. What I'm saying is, because the way they have this outline is that they're funneling this into these 32 existing committees that are already out there. And, you know, we're not, now, I mean, you can also claim that the lack of effectiveness of the HRC committees is because they're underfunded, but I don't think that is really a legitimate argument ultimately. But it does, it seems like throwing money, which when you spread it across 32 committees is not all that much money in any kind of targeted sense, depending on how it's distributed. And it would be more effective to do what you're saying, where you take an area that is under siege and have more of a strategic plan on how that money is going to be invested. I mean, it just sounds like, and this is one of my problems with the advocacy groups, is they have become so big and so bureaucratic that the funding is not apparent going towards, you know, the really most effective places, but it's going to fund this bureaucratic infrastructure, which is expensive, and people showing up for work and doing all this stuff in areas where virtually nothing is going on.
Well, the problem that I have with it is that, you know, in conversations I've had with people like Toby, like Will, and others across the United States, is that it's a perception. You know, when you speak about the human rights campaign and grassroots engagement, what exactly are they doing? I get asked that question a lot. It's, what exactly are they doing? You know, you look at Will's staff in Memphis, I can tell you exactly what they're doing. If you look at Equality Texas's staff in Houston in particular, I can tell you exactly what they're doing. All right. I can tell you about the Get Out the Vote. I can tell you about the phone calls. I can tell you about the door-to-door campaigns. I can tell you about the phone banks. I can tell you about the demonstrations and the show of strength, you know, waving signs on busy street intersections. So my question to the human rights campaign, therefore, is, are you going to shore up this effort? Because, you know, of what use is it to spend that kind of money if we have an infrastructure in place that, A, not only knows the community, but, B, could probably do it better than you? If you want to expand,
right,
then maybe we should expand our communications capabilities so that everybody is on the same, you know, wavelength and that everybody understands. At the end of the day, and the other part of it is that they constantly talk about the Trump-Pence, you know, agenda. All right, I disagree with that. Yeah, I have said repeatedly, you know, the Trump-Pence agenda is not the problem. The problem is, even in of itself, grassroots at a state level, or with organizations like the Alliance Defending Freedom, Liberty Council, the American Family Association, the Family Research Council, Focus on the Family, different groups in states like Minnesota, where, I'll give you an example there, they are still having trouble 7 years later after the pandemic, where we lost 9 kids to suicide, 5 of whom we
right.
know were LGBT, okay? And the people that caused the problem in the first place, the Minnesota family groups, are still there, and there's nothing that can be done because There's no groups in Minnesota that can fight back to counter these people. So let's not talk about Trump Pence. We need to talk about
local level. Yeah, because they list the Trump Pence things that are not particularly relevant to LGBT. I mean, there are things that we're fighting, you know, on the progressive side that I know I'm involved in anyway, like, you know, the ridiculousness of a border wall, you know, the immigration policies, the, you know, the Muslim ban, all of those things are things that, you know, I'm already, you know, I'm already involved with as a progressive individual. But when I look to my advocacy for LGBTQ, I need them to focus on real strategy and tactics against the issues that are hitting our community. And what I'm seeing is PR stuff. For example, you know, Chad came out with this thing for Trump when he went met with Putin about, you know, mention Chechnya, which is like, great. You know, that sounds good on the surface because, you know, Chechnya is a big issue. We should be doing something about it. But the request for Trump to mention it in that meeting was spitting in the wind. Nobody believed that was going to happen. Nobody would have, you know, thought that was a realistic request. Why isn't HRC working on a real policy about Chechnya with the Trump administration that isn't waiting for the one photo op where Trump is going to be under enormous, ridiculous, can't win, damned if he does, damned if he does, doesn't, you know, timing to bring up something that we know he wouldn't bring up. If he did bring it up, Putin wouldn't even listen to it in that time frame. It was just the bottom line, it was a PR stunt for HRC to look like they were doing something. And it was completely ineffective. And didn't
well,
work.
And
the other one.
The thing is that.
Wait, there's another one this week where, and you and I have been talking about this for a whole other reason because it was another show I want to do, and because there is a situation where a trans family was attacked on social media by an actor who is a jerk, and you know.
Let me
you know,
correct the gender. Gender fluid, not trans. The kid's gender fluid.
Oh,
but
I'm sorry. Gender fluid. Gender fluid. But the point is that it's something that we need vocalization around it, defending them. You know, no situation was occurring that needed any kind of government action, and yet HRC, you know, full bore behind this family. Great, but it's all PR. You know, and when we've got issues where trans rights are being threatened in so many states across the country to focus on, you know, a PR thing where Neil Patrick Harris was much more effective at calling him out than anything the HRC has done around it, it seems misguided to me.
I think the other part of this, too, now, again, I will give, you know, Jennifer and her staff tremendous credit for the yeoman work that they did on the issue with the Hartzler Amendment to the NDAA. That is an effective use of resources by the Human Rights Campaign. And that's the type of thing, okay, that I can get behind and I can applaud because that's the type of thing that we need. But if you're going to turn right around and say, okay, well, HRC is going to expand efforts and staff, you know, in, you know, all these other places, yeah, 32 existing volunteer-led steering committees, yada, 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 you know, allocating national grassroots. Why are you not taking that same money, those same resources, that type of engagement, and shoring up the people who, quite frankly, are already on the ground battling this and, you know, push come to shove are probably more of an expert at it than, you know, the crew sitting in D.C. It's not sitting okay with me. What happened with the amendment is a perfect example of how HRC can be extremely effective on a national issue, utilizing sources to combat something that affected, you know, a lot of people. But when it comes down to the local state initiatives and things, they're better served, and these local organizations are better served if the Human Rights Campaign will put the resources behind them. The problem is with local legislators. The problem is with local legislators, okay, in the state houses, in the city councils. You know, if HRC wants to put in and shore up efforts so that we can continue to elect members of our own community, like Mayor Parker, for example, the former mayor of Houston, all right, or even, Mayor Castro of San Antonio, who's, now obviously serving at a federal level, but it was an ally, you know, and in countless other examples across the United States, then that's fine. But let's talk about the problem. The problem is local specific too. You know, years ago to O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, I was fortunate enough to interview him, and there's two things that he told me, one of which was his mantra. I think he said this to every journalist, every visitor to the office when he was Speaker of the House, and that was, all politics is local, okay? The Speaker wasn't kidding.
Right.
The other thing that the Speaker added, he said, Brody, but remember that politics is the art of perception and persuasion. Now, I've never forgotten that. And, you know, if the Human Rights Campaign wants to take a good, hard look at what Speaker O'Neill said, you know, 30-some years ago, and then apply it to today, I think they would better serve, you know, their constituency, which is the entire community, and each of these communities being served by people who are eminently qualified because they're the ones there. These are the people that this is their town, their communities. You know, Equality California, for example, they have finally turned it around. I mean, for a very long time, Equality California was a hot mess. And I think that was a known factor, not only to us in the press, but even people within the movement. It was disorganized. It was constantly in turmoil. And it just terrible. At the end of the day, it wasn't effective. Well, they've turned it around.
Right.
You know, they brought in new people. They brought in new expertise. They focused in on things that matter, and it's working. Now, if Chad and HRC senior staff would come in and say, okay, Equality California, you need some help here. Here's a check for, you know, $1.5 million. What can we do also to help you expand and recruit and, you know, accompany your efforts at engagement, communications, digital staff, whatever you need? You know, can we give you some of our volunteers? What are you working on? What are our problem areas? Do we have politicians that we need to target, you know, in Sacramento? Do we have propositions that we need to be concerned about? Do we need to be concerned about, you know, the right wing and one of the family values groups that's going to, you know, cause trouble, such as the Capital Institute or SaveCalifornia.com and wonderful folks up there? You know, whatever the case is, and I'm just using California, your home state, as an example, but that would be, to
right.
me, a strategic use of assets, and it would also make common sense. Now, if the Human Rights Campaign, you know, was to follow that, yeah, I don't have a problem with HRC doing the national stuff because, like I said, and I'll beat a dead horse, Jennifer and her crew did a wonderful job with the Hartzler Amendment, especially today, and we beat the damn thing. And that's a great thing, and that's a good thing, and that's playing nice in the sandbox, that's working as a team, and that's a good use for the Human Rights Campaign. But you will
well,
not convince
I'm, no, I'm
me
glad you, I'm glad
that
you,
the Human Rights
I'm
Campaign
glad you,
is going into Mississippi, okay, and setting up shop without checking about the activists and the folks on the ground, okay, in Jackson, in Tupelo, in places in Mississippi where they're having problems, is such a good idea. I don't necessarily agree with that.
Yeah, no, I going back, though, I'm glad you keep going back to the win today and that effective use of what they're doing. My perception also is that this has a lot to do with infrastructure in terms of where investments have been made. And I see this from having worked in the AIDS, HIV activism, you know, area for decades. Because when I first started doing it, you know, we were going into things that looked, you know, they were decorated like garages. I mean, they were cold concrete floors and, you know, folding chairs and, you know, dirt all over the place. And I mean, that's what we were working out of. And then, you know, we did AIDS walks and AIDS funding and all this stuff and everything else. And all of a sudden you're walking to high rise buildings with, you know, receptionists and glass and chrome, and, you know, it's all very, you know, professional and high end. And, you know, I look at that and going, okay, this is where the funding's going. You know, this is going, you know, in other words, these were built to solve a challenge, to go after a challenge. And the answer to going after a challenge was they decided to build a business around it. Well, that business needs constant feeding to sustain. I mean, that's what, you know, for commercial businesses do. They sell product, they sell services, and that pays those big skyrides, you know, executive business units. And this model has got to change. It can't be eating that up, because the funding that is coming in is going to feed the infrastructure, and it doesn't get to the street. And we have some real street challenges that we need that help right now.
I think it's a human rights campaign, you know, and they're talking about this thing with the so-called Trump-Pence thing. Look, fine. You know, you're a national organization. You're D.C.-based. If you want to take on the vice president of the United States, please be my guest, okay, because the vice president of the United States, quite frankly, is a credible threat or a clear and present danger, to use the vernacular of the government of the United States, to the rights of the entire LGBTQI community. But, you know, we've got local organizations that could be galvanized into action, and I think with proper funding and initiative and leadership from the Human Rights Campaign can do the job, and I think that the Human Rights Campaign can focus its effort, you know, in a larger sense. Yeah, it's a delegation of authority. It's not unlike, in a political sense, here you have the Democratic National Committee, which is the umbrella group. Then you have the Democratic Congressional Committee. The Republicans have the RNC and the Republican Congressional Committee. My point is that there's a delegation of responsibility. There's a delegation of accountability. And most importantly, there's an allocation of funds in a strategic sense. So if HRC wants to be strategic in combating, okay, the threat that is posed by the administration in terms of an overall, then focus in like they did today. But if you're going to have a problem child congressman like Steve King in Iowa, who is anti-gay, anti-immigrant, oh my God, there's an anti-list with him, why don't you get a hold of the folks in Iowa, like One Iowa, the group out there, and let them fight the battle? Give them the
right
support. Give them the logistics. Give them the tools that they need. You know, if that includes bringing in a bunch of army of volunteers to, you know, augment or supplement what they're doing to, you know, throw King's ass out of office in 2018, I'm good with that. But it
right
should
well
be,
and
it's
wait,
thought,
I wonder,
you know?
I want to stay on that point, though, that you just made, the throwing of anybody out of office, which, you know, I kind of want to get into the gossip mode of what's going on in Washington this week and get your perspective on that. But before I do, touching on the transition here with HRC, mm-hmm, let's just say, for sake of argument, and I know you don't think this is going to happen, but just pretend that, you know, some sort of out of office thing was going to happen with Trump, you know, either impeachment or he, you know, he goes nuts and everybody realizes he's nuts and they throw him out, or, you know, he resigns or something happens. The point you just brought up, to me, should be the backroom conversation that HRC is losing their lunch over right now, in that, mm-hmm, if something happens with Trump, we are stuck with Pence. And Trump is,
yeah,
absolutely a disaster on all fronts and a danger and a threat to this country. Pence is not all that much better, except in some areas, but he is rabidly anti-LGBT, and we would,
yeah,
be, you know, sort of literally out of the frying pan into the proverbial fire with Pence. And HRC should have a almost like an impeachment strategy, you know, that they're cooking up. You know, it's, we will be affected. And, you know, I'm not getting that that's even in their consciousness.
Well, and again, you know, the thing is that no one was really aware, except for myself and a few other people, just how invested in this particular positioning the vice president was. We had indications of it, but we didn't have any good sourcing or intelligence on the ground. We finally got it. And again, it's no great shock. There are people that can tell you, Jeremy Davis, who is the executive director of the AFL-CIO's Pride at Work, and I've had conversations about Mike Pence numerous times. Pence is a danger because he's a zealot. Pence is a danger because he absolutely believes, in Christian supremacy and America being a Christian nation. He's a dominionist, the seven hill dominion. He's a danger. He's a threat. And it's not just the LGBTQI community. Jeremy's pointed out that Pence, you know, women's reproductive rights, that's out the door. And there's a few other things that are out the door as well. Strategically, looking at this administration, I mean, I'm being perfectly honest with you. Trump's not going anywhere, The Republicans in Congress are not about to get rid of the goose that laid the golden eggs. You know, Trump is a reality star running a very poorly written, poorly acted out reality show that unfortunately is the White House right now, and it's stumbling along.
Brody, let me ask you a question on that, because I know that's your thoughts on it, but why, from their perspective, why isn't Pence golden goose number two? I mean, if they, Trump is getting in a position right now where no one would blame anyone for the removal of Donald Trump. You know, nobody would turn to the Republicans and go, what the hell are you thinking? You just tossed out a good guy. I don't think anybody at this point would go, eh. But if they did toss him out, they've got Mike Pence sitting right there who will actually more likely get through their agenda in a much more effective manner than Trump would. So why do you feel Trump is so protected when number two would probably be much better for the Republican Party anyway?
Actually, the truth of the matter is Mike Pence would not be better for the Republican Party. Number one, Mike Pence served in the House. He didn't make a lot of friends there. He's got no friends on the Senate side. He's not very well liked. When he was governor of Indiana, he pulled some policy things that made him extremely unpopular. He's not a team player. He doesn't play nice in the sandbox. Party-wise, he doesn't have really what it takes in order to be able to govern successfully. Governing has got to be done by consensus and has to be done by bipartisan or even strategic partisan means. Cannot do that. If you look at his record as Indiana's governor, it's pretty grim. His record in Congress is even more so. He's a single solitary issue person, and that's social agendas. He's good at that. You know, as governor, you look at his record as governor, it's a confirmed kill. The state is just now starting to recover from that. Pence and the legislature, which is predominantly Republican, didn't get along. So the Republican leadership of both parts of the bicameral, both the Senate and the House, would rather have Trump, who literally in their eyes is a flaming idiot that will sign anything because he's a buffoon. You don't want to get rid of the goose that laid the golden egg. If you end up with Pence, there's going to be one fight after the other after the other. It will be worse for the Republicans than the fighting they did with the Obama administration. I kid you not. Pence is a theocratic zealot. That is not going to go over well with the moderates in that party, and that includes the leadership, including the current majority leader. Also keep in mind, they don't have a full control of that Senate come 2018. It's going to get worse for them. Gerrymandering in the House or not.
We need to make that happen. Absolutely. You know, I'm thinking as you're talking, it's like you really need to be the head of the HRC. You really do. You need to go in there, take over, and set the direction. I mean, you know where all the bodies are buried. You know what needs to be done, and you know the messaging that needs to be rolling out there. So we've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to hear your take on Donald Jr. and the meetings and the Russians and, Donald Sr. He knew, he didn't know, he didn't know, he does know, what do you think? What the hell is going on there?
I've had congressional sources who are constitutional lawyers and experts tell me that Donald Jr. has, in fact, probably violated federal election statutes, three of which alone are felonies. That is in of itself enough to put him behind bars, okay? That Manafort and Kushner are probably in the same boat, Miller to a lesser degree. Bannon, ironically, is the only one that comes up to him like roses in that scenario. As far as the president is concerned, given the information and the intelligence and sourcing we've had on Donald Trump, and this goes back over decades, nothing happens without his knowledge. Those children of his do not make any kind of maneuver or decision without, Papa weighing in on it. So it's a virtual certainty that he knew. Now, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, if a bill of true attainder is reached by a grand jury, okay, the problem that you run into is a sitting U.S. president cannot be indicted nor can be arrested. But the U.S. attorney can present it to the attorney general or present it directly to Speaker Ryan and the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. They can initiate articles of impeachment. He's got up until the last minute of the last vote on the House floor. He could pardon himself. After that, no. Once he's impeached, he's done.
Well,
the real question is,
how
many else does he impeach? I mean, how many other people before he gets impeached does he pardon at the same time? The last question,
exactly.
I know you're going to ask it, and I'll answer it. He will not resign. This guy's ego will not allow him to resign. So we are in this for the long haul.
Well, I wasn't going to ask that, but I was going to ask more about competency. You know, what has to happen for people to just say, and we have like 2 minutes, what has to happen for people to just declare him incompetent?
You mean the 25th Amendment?
Yes. Or I mean, what other angle that Congress needs to step in and say?
The only way the 25th Amendment of the United States Constitution will be invoked, is if he starts a war. That's it. There's nothing else. Something horrible will have to happen before that thing gets triggered. That simple.
So the last one is politically, because that is where I think this could all implode for the Republican Party, for Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be a point where even the most diehards look at it and in the midterms go, we got to put a muzzle on these people. Not even toss them out of office, but we got to put the Senate back where there's control over Trump and the House, and potentially we need a new House. I mean,
if that were to
I have
occur,
to believe we
way,
have a better shot of that than we did before.
If the American electoral body, that means all of the Americans, are angry enough at this Congress and at the Republican Party to put the Democrats or at least a progressive Congress back into play, they're going to need a democratically controlled majority in the House to impeach Trump. It is that simple.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not talking impeachment at that point. I'm just talking about getting sanity back in. But we are at the end of the show. Thank you, Prody, so much. We could go on, and we have and we will. So thank you for being part of this again. Also, I want to mention out in Santa Cruz this week on tomorrow or Saturday night, we will be talking about trans women and women's issues and are they quote unquote real women. We have a wonderful article we're going to go through on why they are and make that case, because there are a lot of feminists that have raised ugly arguments, and we are going to refute them, and that will be a show you don't want to miss on www.kso.com, 7 p.m. live streaming. Come back next week on Rated LGBT Radio. We will have another great show. And again, my ultimate thanks and always to Mr. Brody Levesque, who, since he has no more time to interrupt, is one of the best journalists ever. Thanks for listening. Listen next week.